My name's Paul Monaghan, I'm at Adelaide Uni. I work in a program called the Mobile Language Team, and it's about, I think, our fourth year of operation. We try and go out and deal with language programs, setting up programs, helping language programs in the state of South Australia with Aboriginal communities. I come from a background of museums, libraries and archives. I've worked across that sector, but also I've worked in as a linguist and anthropologist as well. So I'll give you this background just to try and place this paper. And this paper really is an attempt to think through a translation issue, which is a practical issue, and which is coming, you know, at the other end of what we've just been discussing. What actually happens when you get the materials out of the archive, and what happens when they start being, you know, worked on by people in communities. So in this paper, I discuss the translation of a dreaming story from English back into the extremely endangered Wurundjeri language of the far west coast of South Australia. As Aboriginal cultural materials are increasingly being recovered from museums, archives and libraries, I hope to illustrate a number of distinctive features of this process, and that may be applicable to similar settings within Australia and thus useful for others approaching a similar task. I take it as axiomatic, following Derrida, that a translation is never complete. Derrida treats the biblical Tower of Babel as a potent symbol for incompleteness, in addition to its more common value of proliferation in terms of language diversity, or explaining language diversity. The notion of incompleteness limits the idea of a final, complete, or true translation. According to a prominent, if controversial, critic of translation theories, George Steiner, it can be argued that all theories of translation, formal, pragmatic, chronological, are only variants of a single inescapable question. In what ways can or ought fidelity be achieved? What is the optimal correlation between the A text and the source language and the B text and the receptor language? In the translation process discussed in this paper, which is essentially one of group rather than individual translation, the notion of fidelity or optimal correlation, as Steiner puts it, rests in fact upon a pragmatist notion of truth. That is, truth, as reflected in a true translation, is an emergent property of a text that has the potential to serve as an instrument for social action. The truth of a translation is determined by the social uses one may wish to make of the resulting text, whether it be written or oral. The ways that Wurundjeri people make meaning in the translation process, what makes sense for them, depends upon their own personal and cultural lived experience. It is against the background of a form of life that understanding arises. Understanding, following Wittgenstein, consists in knowing how to act in a particular form of life. In our case of the Bilal translation, which I'll show in a minute, understanding depends to a significant degree on who participates in the translation process. Gadamer's notion of translation as a conversation is useful here. It is a creative dialogical process in which the goal is not known in advance. It's also a process of cultural rediscovery and self-understanding for the participants. This is quoting one of the participants. It's amazing what we can find in one little story. But I want to add that this is not an arbitrary process, however, as there are normative pressures as well as ideals of consensus at work in this translation process. Another arguably stronger constraining force is a set of highly literate practices related to archival and linguistic practices that include what I call a reverence for the colonial text and the need to employ word-for-word techniques in back translation and morpheme-by-morpheme construction in the target language, which, among other things, is very useful for didactic purposes when we're talking about a language revival project. The latter is a requirement demanded by the partial, fragmented, and reduced nature of the Wurundjeri language, but ultimately It's the responsibility of the storyteller, to quote one of the Wirunga translators, which outweighs what I call the reverence for the text and the and its author, that is foundational to high-level literate practices and the culture and divisions it more broadly supports and reproduces. What this responsibility of the storyteller consists in for Wirunga translators is expressed in the following comment made by one of the participants. So what are you trying to do here? Translate word for word, or are you trying to make sense of a story? That's what you've got to decide. And hopefully I can elaborate that on that a little bit as we talk this paper. Now, this is the far west of South Australia. The story I'm talking about was recorded at Eucla, which is right on the edge of the map over here. Daisy Bates, who collected the story, was based there at the turn of the 20th century. She also worked at Fowler's Bay in a place called Uria, and also Aldea, which is probably more widely known as an important crossroads in Aboriginal Australia, where the desert and the coastal cultures come to mix. The Wurundjeri language is a highly endangered member of the Thuru-Yura subgroup of the Parmenyungan family, although its topological status is not settled. Simpson and Herkus, for example, refer to it as an outlier of that group. And the situation is complicated by long-term, probably pre-colonial language contact with Western Desert languages, which sit above them spatially and which form a different group. Subgroup, sorry. What is currently known of the language is largely reconstructed from written colonial records, and the memories of two elderly speakers, but unfortunately one of those has recently passed away. So we're talking about one speaker left of Wurundjeri. Louise Herkus wrote a salvage grammar published in 1999 with many, we also produced a dictionary of 1600 headwords. Both of which sort of belie the Humboldtian position that language in actuality only exists in spoken discourse, and its grammar and dictionary are hardly even comparable to its dead skeleton, where Humboldt's words from 18 something. But against that, the documentation and revival of this language has been undergone for the last 15 years. Now, this is the story in question, which is recorded in English, although this is a typical Daisy Bates type of text. It's littered with Aboriginal words, some of which are from the Pidgin English of the time. Now, this was found in the Bar Smith Library at the University of Adelaide, although it was located in a folio of files called Eucla Myths. If I just go back to that map, we'll see that Eucla, according to this map, is in Mernin country, but most of the language in here relates to Wurundjeri. And Bates was also a very important source for Louise Herkus when she was writing the Wurundjeri grammar. Now, the task of translating this story arose during a TAFE course that I was running in Sojourner with five Aboriginal students, mature age students. So the course was called Learning an Endangered Aboriginal Language, and we had a cultural advisor in the classroom that we could refer to help us elaborate parts of the story. But again, it was a group translation process. So just briefly, most of those students were in the 35 to 50 age bracket. The cultural advisor was over 60. The latter person, are recognised as a senior Wurundjeri woman, runs a cultural awareness business and brought to the task an added level of authority and seniority. One of the students was male, a well-travelled man in his 30s who was multilingual in Aboriginal languages. Two of the women were sisters, daughters of the one remaining elderly Wurundjeri speaker, and two other members of the class were an Aboriginal woman and her non-Aboriginal daughter who was raising two children and wanted to speak Wurundjeri to them. So overall, the perspective of the group was one of conservatism when it came to heritage and language matters. No one in the class knew the story, even though traditional stories are no longer transmitted in Wurundjeri or English, the students were familiar with aspects of dreaming stories. Okay, so let's just move on to the next slide. Now what I've done is just broken the story up into three parts. And really I just want to talk about the first part. There's two lines of a song which we don't understand at the moment, but just looking at this first part of the story, this is something that I found really fascinating. Old woman making a whirly, a bough shelter for the rain sings, old woman Bilal. Bilal's the name of a bird in the area. She asks which way water comes in through the whirly. Inside, young weena, young woman, a dulgara, young married woman, can't speak and points out with wada, which just means thing, but it's a stick, and shows where water comes. So just those first four lines caused a lot of interesting problems. I've asked a number of people what they make of that in terms of what's actually happening, what's the action there? The four basic questions I think that the group wanted to look at was, what is the nature of the action taking place? How many people and beings are involved? And that's throughout the story. So there's this bit about rain and building. Then the son, who's Nunga, sees Nunga bringing Malu, which is kangaroo. So her son goes off and brings a kangaroo back. She gets the best part, which is the ribs and thighs. And there's this there's relationships going on about speech taboos, the mother-in-law, the daughter-in-law, and her son, and this spirit being who's attacking her son, and eventually they all come back. But the question is, what's going on in the first part of that story? Can you read that? So, I've just coded down, there's different people speaking here, on PM. So, M for male and senior woman. So this is what they made of it. Now, when I was working on the story at first, I thought, I'll just go back to that story, that there's an old woman making a shelter for the rain and she's singing. Then she asked the young woman inside which way the water's coming in through as she's building it. And I was totally wrong. And a lot of people read it, some sort of variation of that way. Now, if we look at the actual transcript here of the translation process, we have, we're just at the end of it where they've decided that it's actually a woman who's singing the rain up. She's singing to the rain. Now the senior woman goes, but I thought that was a continuation of the story about her building that, making that camp because the rain's coming. So what's actually going on? Is the rain coming or is she making the rain come? Well, that's what we were talking about. Is she singing the rain? She's singing a song and she's making the shelter. Yeah, because of shelter. Yeah. In expectation of rain coming. So then the man says, so you could just say, if you're looking at the context of a story, you could say, Gabi Renata Wanina. And that literally means the rain is falling, the big rain. And what I'm going to suggest as we go through this is, it's continually moving more and further away from what's written on the page. And there's a way of getting inside this story that brings out the meaning for people. And now I've just tried to summarise it here in the interest of time, we'll move on. I'm summarising this point. I'm saying that there's two main interpretations. Is it raining at the time, or is she bringing this rain? Then the senior woman's saying she's singing for the rain again. Another person in the class says she's doing the rain song. So again, we're just locked around this, but then interestingly, I'm saying that Daisy Bates, we're talking about Daisy Bates, translated back into Wurundjeri and that was recorded at UCLA, and then there's this strong statement about who owns the story. It's not Daisy Bates' story. And through this translation process, as I said earlier on, there's this process of discovery, of ownership. There's different forms of social action that will come from this text. It's going to become very important. You can see there's this decision-making process as well. And right at the end, there's an agreement between the male and the senior woman were the two out of the class of five, or that made six altogether, who were the most active in it. But there was definitely a negotiation of the meaning as they were going through it. People wanted to make sure that everyone was in agreement with what was being proposed. So the meaning emerged through this process. Let's quickly get back to just a brief discussion. In his paper, The Task of the Translator, Walter Benjamin writes, "Unlike a work of literature, translation does not find itself in the centre of the language forest, but on the outside, facing the wooded ridge. It calls into it without entering, aiming at that single spot where the echo is able to give, in its own language, the reverberation of the work in the alien one." Now, this is a beautifully poetic image of transformation and reduction, in contrast to the solidity of the written word of literature is the transient echo of the translation. The transformation inherent to the move from text to text is echo too in the transformation and reduction of speech into writing. How are we over time?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot of stuff that is missed, and as linguists, most people seem to be linguists in this room, would know that as you move in that process of speech to writing, a lot needs to be left out. I was just going to read out this one last passage from the Burns, who published a book in 1989 on Aboriginal myths and did a lot of work at Aldea as well. Produced a great number of texts while they were working there. And this is a point about inferential meanings, which is another thing that's lost. They recorded that people spoke, and I'm quoting, the same language in the sense that, in the sense of understanding unspoken comments. They didn't need to have everything spelled out, either in ordinary conversation, in mythical stories, or in other circumstances. Oral communication is such a situation, involved more than the physical presence or potential presence of other people listening to what was said or sung. It also involved knowing or inferring what was not said, a level of communication that is possible in small-scale communities, but much harder to achieve in large-scale ones, except within specialist groups or on limited topics. So in this process of creating this text, which looks something like this, when it's finally translated, there was a huge amount of input, which I call pragmatic explications, were going on amongst that group. To look at that original text and to work within it, the key points here are, I'm just going to finish on this key point, this idea of, they replaced this idea of reverence for the text and its author with a notion of presence. Their word, not mine. You have to be present, I was told. You've got to be physically there. It's not only translating like you're in the classroom. Another participant elaborates. You've got to place yourself out there and act the story out in your head like you're there, innit? These attitudes attest most clearly to the Wurundjeri belief that the meaning is not in the words. Oral narratives, as Walter Ong typically pointed out, are typically close to the human life world. And the life world, as I was told, is equated with common sense. This is in the Sojourner context. So just to finish with a quote, as the senior woman says, you've got to connect it back to your surroundings, the natural environment, says one woman. I mentioned the life world as a fancy word for it. The place where meanings and interpretations are grounded. And she says, that's common sense. People say, use your common sense. Clearly notions of presence requires experience and is crucial for this understanding. So, I'll just leave it there. And see if there's any questions.
Thank you.
questions?
Oops. That wasn't good, was it?
That's the Mac you've got to...
It doesn't have to go back.
No.
All right.
Good.
Any questions for Paul? Yes.
So did DaisyBase give you much information about the text, about the context of it, or...?
No.
Basically just have
a text. So you have a text, and once you really look at it, there's layers and layers of it's like a palimpsest, because there was a typist who was employed, I think, at the point when Daisy Bates was sending her stuff to the National Library, and they employed a typist, and so there's that section of it in Adelaide. Yeah, look, there's bits in here where one of the questions, as I said before, was how many people are actually there? And that relates to these transitivity markers, which track them up. You know, to me, would be track them up in Pidgin English, but they're in the Wurundjeri people are literally taking that as a pronoun. And so I can't, Daisy Bates couldn't bring herself to do anything in Pidgin. She hated it, and she published it. You know, she published comments on that while she was sitting around having cups of tea to settle tribal disputes. So there's nothing much in there. You'd have to really pick around and, if you've worked with Daisy Bates' material. But again, this was in the Euclid Myths, and again, there's really... it's very complicated because these here are also Kogata words. The words in this line, and there's a particular meaning in Kogata for this one here, which is a... Well, we're taking it as a relationship term, but it's actually the guts of the kangaroo in Yunkinjara as well. So there's this sort of added complexity to it. Sorry.
I want to add a bit more complexity. That second line of the song there.
Yep.
Assuming that is actually Bilal.
Yep.
That construction is typical of Arundic song.
Ah.
Where you sort of take the end of
any
word and stick it on the end.
That's nice. Well, it's extremely rare that you get a word initial R in Wurundjeri as well, so I don't know whether that adds another. That's very interesting.
So maybe the word boundaries are being played around with a bit.
Yeah, right. That's a good point, actually. I wonder if So I haven't seen the original, but there should be a handwritten version of it somewhere. Again, in a big folio of there's a whole lot of these on birds, and we're just sort of working through it. So I hope to find out more next week, because I'm going back to Sojourner next week to look at that song bit, if I can, of interesting possibilities.
Can I ask a quick question? Has there been an attempted retranslation of the translation back into English?
What happened was I did the... The one that I showed you, here's the second one. I did one based on a word-to-word translation, and it was so wide of the mark of how people did it. No one's tried to do the back translation back from that into English. Might be an interesting exercise, but no one can speak. They'd have to do it with a dictionary, because no one can speak. Well, there's one Wurundjeri speaker. I'll ask him next week. I might do that. But it's far more complicated and complex than I'd imagine when I thought, well, this would be a good thing to do in the class, you know? and then there's the added question of, will it remain a text? Is this text a text? One of the things that I'll be doing next week is trying to... in the past, people out there have memorised text and delivered it as a verbal performance of sort of linguistic competence. So this one might go into a master apprentice program where... people are learning to tell this as a story. So, but then again, it could be used for, you know, a nice 10-page storybook for kids in the childcare. So.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank the speaker. And the time.